Speechware Document 37. Utilizing our natural resources. Address delivered before the National Editorial Association in Jamestown, Virginia, June 10, 1907. It is of course a mere truism to say that no other body of our countrymen wield as extensive an influence as those who write for the daily press and for the periodicals. It is also a truism to say that such power implies the gravest responsibility, and the man exercising it should hold himself accountable, and should be held by others accountable, precisely, as if he occupied any other position of public trust. I do not intend to dwell upon your duties today, however, save that I shall permit myself to point out one matter, where it seems to me that the need of our people is vital. It is essential that the man in public life and the man who writes in the public press shall both of them, if they are really good servants of the people, be prompt to assail wrongdoing and wickedness. But in us assailing wrongdoing and wickedness, there are two conditions to be fulfilled, because, if unfulfilled, harm and not good will result. In the first place, be sure of your facts and avoid everything like hysteria or exaggeration, for to assail a decent man for something of which he is innocent is to give aid and comfort to every scoundrel, while indulgent in hysterical exaggeration serves to weaken, not strengthen, the statement of truth. In the second place, be sure that you base your judgment on conduct and not in the social or economic position of the individual with whom you are dealing. There are good and bad men in every walk of life, and their being good or bad does not depend upon whether they have or do not have large bank accounts. Yet this elemental fact, this fact which we all accept as self-evident, when we think each of us of the people whom he himself knows in his business and social relations, is often completely ignored by certain public men and certain public writers. The men who thus ignore it and who attack wickedness only when found in a particular class are always unsafe, and are sometimes very dangerous, leaders. Distrust equally the man who is never able to discover any vices of rich men to attack and the man who confines himself to attacking the sins and shortcomings of rich men. It is a sure sign of moral and mental dishonesty in any man, if in his public assaults upon iniquity he is never able to see any iniquity save that of a particular class, and this, whether he is able only to see the crimes of arrogance and oppression in the rich or the crimes of envy and violence in the poor. He is no true American, if he is a respecter of persons where right and wrong are concerned, and if he fails to denounce the demagogue no less than the corruptionist, to denounce alike crimes of organized greed and crimes of brutal violence. There is equal need to denounce the wealthy man who swindles investors or buys legislatures or oppresses wage workers, and the needy man who inflames class hatred or incites mob violence. We need to hold the scales of justice even, and to weigh them down in one side is as bad as to weigh them down on the other. So much for what I have to say to you in your capacity of molders and guides of public thought. In addition, I want to speak to you into great movements in our public life which I feel must necessarily occupy no inconsiderable part of the time of our public men in the near future. One of these is the question of, in certain ways, reshaping our system of taxation so as to make it bear most heavily in those most capable of supporting the strain. The other is the question of utilizing the natural resources of the nation in the way that will be of most benefit to the nation as a whole. In utilizing and conserving the natural resources of the nation, the one characteristic more essential than any other is foresight. Unfortunately, foresight is not usually characteristic of the young and vigorous people, and it is obviously not a marked characteristic of us in the United States. Yet assuredly it should be the growing nation with a future which takes the long look ahead, and no other nation is growing so rapidly as ours or has a future so full of promise. No other nation enjoys so wonderful a measure of present prosperity which can of right be treated as an earnest of future success, and for no other are the rewards of foresight so great, so certain, and so easily foretold. Yet hitherto, as a nation we have tended to live with an eye single to the present, and have permitted the reckless waste and destruction of much of our natural wealth. The conservation of our natural resources and their proper use constitute the fundamental problem which underlies almost every other problem of our national life. Unless we maintain an adequate material basis for our civilization, we cannot maintain the institutions in which we take so great and so just a pride, and to waste and destroy our natural resources means to undermine this material basis. During the last 5 years, efforts have been made in several new directions in the government service to get our people to look ahead, to exercise foresight, and to substitute a planned and orderly development of our resources in the place of a haphazard striving for immediate profit. The effort has been made through several agencies. In 1902, the Reclamation Service began to develop the larger opportunities of the western half of our country for irrigation. The work includes all the states from the Great Plains through the Rocky Mountains to the Pacific Slope. It has been conducted with the clear and definite purpose of using the valuable water resources of the public land for the greatest good for the greatest number in the long run, in other words, for the purpose of putting upon the land permanent homemakers who will use and develop it for themselves and for their children and children's children. There has been opposition, of course, to this work of the Reclamation Service, for we have been obliged to antagonize certain men whose interest it was to exhaust for their own temporary personal profit natural resources which ought to be developed through use, so as to be conserved for the permanent common advantage of the people as a whole. But there will be no halt in the work of preserving the waters which head in the Rocky Mountain region so as to make them of most use to the people as a whole, for the policy is essential to our national welfare. The public lands of the United States should be utilized in similar fashion. Our present public land laws were passed when there was a vast surplus of vacant public land. The chief desire was to secure settlers thereon, and comparatively slight attention was paid as to exactly how the lands were disposed of in detail. In consequence, lax execution of the laws became the rule both in the land office and in the public mind, and land frauds were common and little noted. This was especially true when a system originally designed for the fertile and well-watered regions of the Middle West was applied to the drier regions of the Great Plains and to the mountains and to the Pacific coast. In these regions the system lent itself to fraud, and much land passed out of the hands of the government without passing into the hands of the homemaker. The Department of the Interior and the Department of Justice joined in prosecuting the offenders against the law, but both the law and its administration were defective and needed to be changed. 3 years ago a Public Lands Commission was appointed to scrutinize the law and the facts and to recommend a remedy. Their examination specifically showed the existence of great frauds upon the public domain, and their recommendations for changes in the law were made with the design of conserving the natural resources of every part of the public land by putting it to its best use. Attention was especially called to the prevention of settlement by the passage of great areas of public lands into the hands of a few men, and to the enormous waste caused by unrestricted grazing on the open range, a system of using the natural forage in the public domain which amounts to putting a premium in its destruction. The recommendations of the Public Lands Commission were sound, for they were especially in the interests of the actual homemaker, and where the small homemaker could not utilize the land, it was provided that the government should keep control of it, so that it could not be monopolized by a few wealthy men. Congress has not yet acted upon these recommendations, except for the repeal of the iniquitous Lowland Law. But the recommendations are so just and proper, so essential to our national welfare, that I believe they will surely ultimately be adopted. In 1891 Congress authorized the President to create national forests in the public domain. These forest reserves remained for a long time in charge of the General Land Office, which had no men properly trained in forestry. But another department, that of agriculture, possessed the trained men. In other words, the government forests were without foresters and the government foresters without forests. Waste of effort and waste of forests inevitably followed. Finally, the situation was ended in 1905 by the creation of the United States Forest Service, which has stopped the waste, conserved the resources of the national forests, and made them useful, so that our forests are now being managed in a coherent plan, and in a way that augurs well for the future. The mineral fuels of the eastern United States have already passed into the hands of large private owners, and those of the West are rapidly following. This should not be, for such mineral resources belong in a peculiar degree to the whole people. Under private control there is much waste from short-sighted methods of working, and the complete utilization is often sacrificed for a greater immediate profit. The mineral fuels under our present conditions are as essential to our prosperity as the forests will always be. The difference is that the supply is definitely limited, for coal does not grow and trees do. It is obvious that the mineral fuels should be conserved, not wasted, and that enough of them should remain in the hands of the government to protect the people against unjust or extortionate prices so far as that can still be done. What has been accomplished in the regulation of the great oil fields of the Indian Territory offers a striking example of the good results of such a policy. Last summer, accordingly, I withdrew most of the coal-bearing public lands temporarily from disposal, and asked for the legislation necessary to protect the public interest by the conservation of the mineral fuels, that is, for the power to keep the fee in the government and to lease the coal, oil, and gas rights under proper regulation. No such legislation was passed, but I still hope that we shall ultimately get it. In addition to treating a right for the benefit of the whole people the forests and the mineral beds, we should similarly try to preserve for the benefit of all the people the great stretches of public domain, some 300 million acres in all, which are unfit for cultivation by present methods and valuable only for the forage which they supply. This vast area is now open to the free grazing of cattle, sheep, horses, and goats, without restriction or regulation. When population has increased, as is now the case, utter lack of management means that the public domain is turned over to be skinned by men whose only concern is to get what they can out of it at the moment, without any regard to whether or not it is ruined so far as the next generation is concerned. In other words, the range is not so much used as wasted by abuse, and as an incident, conflict and bloodshed frequently arise between opposing users. With the rapid settling of the West, the range is more and more overgrazed. Moreover, much of it cannot be used to advantage, unless it is fenced, for fencing is the only way by which to keep in check the absentee owners of nomad flocks which roam hither and thither, utterly destroying the pasturage and leaving a waste behind, so that their presence is incompatible with the presence of homemakers. Good judges estimate that our public range has now lost nearly half its value, yet fencing is against the law, and as the law now stands it is well nigh impossible to do anything to keep the value of the range. The only practical remedy is to give control of the range to the federal government. Such control would not only stop all conflict but would conserve the forage without stopping its use, as our experience with the national forests has fully proved. It would likewise secure to the West the great benefits of legitimate fencing without interfering in the slightest with the settlement of the country, in the contrary, while promoting the settlement of the country. Hitherto, however, it has not proved possible to get any legislation to secure these ends. The destruction of the public range will continue, until, as a nation, we insist upon the enactment of some such laws as those I have advocated. For several years we have been doing everything in our power to prevent fraud upon the public land. What can be done under the present laws is now being done through the joint action of the Interior Department and the Department of Justice. But fully to accomplish the prevention of fraud there is need of further legislation, and especially of a sufficient appropriation to permit the Department of the Interior to examine certain classes of entries on the ground before they pass into private ownership. The appropriation asked for last winter, if granted, would have put an end to the squandering of the public domain, while it would have prevented any need of causing hardship to individual settlers by holding up their claims. However, the appropriation was not given us, and in consequence it is not possible to secure, as I would like to secure, the natural resources of the public land from fraud, waste, and encroachment. So much for what we are trying to do in utilizing our public lands for the public, in securing the use of the water, the forage, the coal, and the timber for the public. In all four movements, my chief advisor, and the man first to suggest to me the courses which had actually proved so beneficial, was Mr. Gifford Pinchot, the chief of the National Forest Service. Mr. Pinchot also suggested to me a movement supplementary to all of these movements, one which will itself lead the way in the general movement which he represents and with which he is actively identified, for the conservation of all our natural resources. This was the appointment of the Inland Waterways Commission. The inability of the railroads of the United States to meet the demands upon them has drawn public attention forcibly to the use of our waterways for transportation. But it is obvious that this is only one of their many uses, and that a planned and orderly development is impossible, except by taking into account all the services they are capable of rendering. It was upon this ground that the Inland Waterways Commission was recently appointed. Their duty is to propose a comprehensive plan for the improvement and utilization of those great waterways which are the great potential highways of the country. Their duty is also to bring together the points of view of all users of streams, and to submit a general plan for the development and conservation of the vast natural resources of the waterways of the United States. Clearly, it is impossible for the Waterways Commission to accomplish its great task without considering, one, the relation of streams to the conservation and use of all other natural resources, and I have asked that it do so. Here, then, for the first time, the orderly development and planned conservative use of all our natural resources is presented as a single problem. One by one, the individual tasks in this great problem have already been undertaken. One by one, in practical fashion, the methods of dealing with them were worked out. National irrigation has proved itself a success by its actual working. Again, actual experience has shown that the national forests will fulfill the larger purpose for which they were created. All who have thoughtfully studied the subject have come to see that the solution of the public lands question lies with the homemaker, with the settler who lives on his land, and that government control of the mineral fuels and the public grazing lands is necessary and inevitable. Each of these conclusions represented a movement of vast importance which would confer large benefits upon the nation, but which stood by itself. They are connected together into one great fundamental problem, that of the conservation of all our natural resources. Upon the wise solution of this, much of our future obviously depends. Even such questions as the regulation of railway rates and the control of corporations are in reality subsidiary to the primal problem of the preservation in the interests of the whole people of the resources that nature has given us. If we fail to solve this problem, no skill in solving the others will in the end avail us very greatly. Now, as to the matter of taxation. Most great civilized countries have an income tax and an inheritance tax. In my judgment, both should be part of our system of federal taxation. I speak diffidently about the income tax, because one scheme for an income tax was declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court by a 5-4 vote, and in addition it is a difficult tax to administer in its practical workings, and great care would have to be exercised to see that it was not evaded by the very man whom it is most desirable to have taxed, for, if so evaded, it would, of course, be worse than no tax at all, as the least desirable of all taxes is the tax which bears heavily upon the honest, as compared with the dishonest man. Nevertheless, a graduated income tax of the proper type would be a desirable permanent feature of federal taxation, and I still hope that one may be devised which the Supreme Court will declare constitutional. In my judgment, however, the inheritance tax is both a far better method of taxation, and far more important for the purpose I have in view, the purpose of having the swollen fortunes of the country bear in proportion to their size a constantly increasing burden of taxation. These fortunes exist solely because of the protection given the owners by the public. They are a constant source of care and anxiety to the public, and it is eminently just that they should be forced to pay heavily for the protection given them. It is, of course, elementary that a nation has the absolute right to decide as to the terms upon which any man shall receive a bequest or devise from another. We have repeatedly placed such laws in our own statute books, and they have repeatedly been declared constitutional by the courts. I believe that the tax should contain the progressive principle. Whatever any individual receives, whether by gift, bequest, or devise, in life or in death, should, after a certain amount is reached, be increasingly burdened, and the rate of taxation should be increased in proportion to the remoteness of blood of the man receiving from the man giving or devising. The principle of this progressive taxation of inheritance has not only been authoritatively recognized by the legislation of Congress, but it is, now unequivocally adopted in the leading civilized nations of the world, in, for instance, Great Britain, France and Germany. Switzerland led off with the imposition of high progressive rates. Great Britain was the first of the great nations to follow suit, and within the last few years both France and Germany have adopted the principle. In Great Britain all estates worth $5,000 or less are practically exempt from death duties, while the increase is such that, when an estate exceeds $5 million in value and passes to a distant kinsman or stranger in blood, the government receives nearly 18%. In France, under the progressive system, so much of an inheritance, as exceeds $10 million, pays over 20% to the state, if it passes to a distant relative, and 5%, if it passes to a direct heir. In Germany very small inheritances are exempt, but the tax is so sharply progressive that an inheritance not in agricultural or forest lands which exceeds $250,000, if it goes to distant relatives, is taxed at the rate of about 25%. The German law is of special interest, because it makes the inheritance tax an imperial measure, while allotting to the individual states of the empire a portion of the proceeds and permitting them to impose taxes in addition to those imposed by the imperial government. In the United States, the national government has more than once imposed inheritance taxes in addition to those imposed by the states, and in the last instance about one half of the states levied such taxes concurrently with the national government, making a combined maximum rate in some cases as high as 25%, and, as a matter of fact, several states adopted inheritance tax laws for the first time, while the national law was still in force and unrepealed. The French law has one feature which is to be heartily commended. The progressive principle is so applied that each higher rate is imposed only on the excess above the amount subject to the next lower rate. This plan is peculiarly adapted to the working out of the theory of using the inheritance tax for the purpose of limiting the size of inheritable fortunes, since the progressive increase in the rates, according to this mode, may be carried to its logical conclusion in a maximum rate of nearly 100% for the amount in excess of a specified sum, without being confiscatory as to the rest of the inheritance, for each increase in rate would apply only to the amount above a certain maximum. I do not believe that any advantage comes either to the country as a whole or to the individuals inheriting the money by permitting the transmission in their entirety of such enormous fortunes as have been accumulated in America. The tax could be made to bear more heavily upon persons residing out of the country than upon those residing within it. Such a heavy progressive tax is, of course, in no shape or way a tax in thrift or industry, for thrift and industry have ceased to possess any measurable importance in the acquisition of the swollen fortunes of which I speak long before the tax would in any way seriously affect them. Such a tax would be one of the methods by which we should try to preserve a measurable equality of opportunity for the people of the generation growing to manhood. As Lincoln pointed out, there are some respects in which men are obviously not equal, but there is no reason why there should not be an equality of self-respect and of mutual respect, an equality of rights before the law, and at least an approximate equality in the conditions under which each man obtains the chance to show the stuff that is in him when compared with his fellows.